Motorcycle Road Racing. This is episode number 613. I'm Jim McDowell, and I want to apologize for the lateness of this show, guys. That work thing that actually pays the bills kind of got in the way of the fun of the motorcycling, so the show's a little late. Apologize for that, but I plan on making it up to you because I bring to you tonight to talk about Brno as a special guest, my good friend, Joel.
Glad to be here tonight, Jim.
So, see you guys. I deliver. I screw up. I get late. I give you something special. So, with that, let's get on into the show. The first thing I'd like to talk about is a little listener feedback that I got from one Mr. Alan Fleming. And Alan, thank you very much for writing in. But he was on a 10-day vacation in the Nordic countries. As he was there, he was riding through, and he went to the first city was the city of Emerta. Now, this hosted a classic 500 GP street circuit 20 years during the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Now, that would have been interesting to see 500 two-strokes on a true street course. Alan also mentions that it was really neat to drive down the public roads and actually see curbing painted on the actual curbs of a road. Very cool, Alan, like that. Alan also said that he went on to try to find the grave of Jarno Saracen in Turku, I believe that's correct. He was looking for that to pay homage to the great man himself, but it could not find it without a map. Next time, maybe GPS might help there, Alan. And also, the last thing he did, he gave us a nice report on the Kimi Ring, the new circuit that is just out of sight of Liti. The place is obviously still under construction, but it looks as though, according to Alan, that it will be a great track because it's located in a natural valley where we can look out across everything and see the track. All the asphalt appears to have been laid, but the work is now on the landscaping, facilities, and the roads leading into and out of the track. Alan, sounds like you had an absolutely incredible vacation. I am jealous of you, sir, but thank you for the update. With that, let us talk a little bit about the news. So, Jorge Lorenzo, he had that terrible crash in Spain where he may have potentially maybe broken his neck or vertebrae in his neck and vertebrae in his back. Or then at the next race, there at Aston, when he fell off in practice, potentially. We now know that he will not be racing again until Silverstone, letting everything heal. Now, he was supposed to be back for Brno. He's not. Not back until Silverstone. But with the beginning of Brno, we now have the official kickoff to the silly season in MotoGP. So first up, Sam Lowes will not be with the Federal Oil Gresini team next year. He says that he has a ride in the MotoGP paddock and that he'll be around for at least two more years. We'll let the guessing games begin because we are not going to be told anything until we get to Silverstone. So does that mean there's a British team with a British triumph, with a British rider? I don't know. Speculation is going to run wild here, but I, you know, given the timing and the fact that we have triumph there, I got to go with it. What do you think, Joel? Making sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. But what do you think Sam's earned a right to be on a MotoGP bike?
He's going to probably be on a Moto2 bike.
Moto2?
I don't think he's going up to MotoGP. I don't think he's going there. I mean, the Lowe's boys are definitely talented guys, but I mean, I think there's just times when you just think you just want them to finish a race instead of falling off. But you know, you never know how far you can push until you actually do crash. But I think there's something brewing. I think he may be his own team. It might be maybe that they have a British sponsor kind of thing going on. Just the fact that they're announcing it at Silverstone because you got British race, British rider. Triumph engines, something's going on there. So speculative. Also in Moto2 silly season news, Lecuona will leave the American Racing KTM squad and join the factory team with Jorge Martin, then the AO Red Bull KTM. Obviously he's replacing Brad Binder, who moves up to MotoGP with KTM. Good choice, bad choice of the group? Yes, no?
Yeah, it's a pretty good choice. I think all in all, I think he's got the talent to step up and be a big game changer.
And Lecuona has actually looked pretty good this year, riding on the frame that no one else can actually ride. I mean, he was looking on for the podium at Sachsenring and wasn't able to do that. Was not able to do it because he actually fell. Probably the good move. I mean, you know, KTM's got to look at who's coming up and who's there. So I definitely think that that's probably the smart move. It doesn't necessarily surprise me. They had to pull somebody to be on the factory team, and you've already got Jorge Martin, so you got to find somebody to compliment him. Lecuona seems like a good choice. Next, we have a rumor around Chavez Verge. Now, Chavez, as I've said, is kind of like disappeared all of a sudden in Moto2. Well, he may be gone from the entire MotoGP paddock, as the rumor mill has him on a World Superbike next year. So, interesting. Good luck to Chavez if he goes, but again, it's all just rumors and it's just silly season. For all we know, Chavez will be signing a multi-year contract to ride alongside Alex Marquez again in the Australia Galassi team. And lastly, now since we're only like a day away from the race in Austria, a super hot rumor that Jorge Lorenzo will leave Honda and he will ride for go back to Ducati on the Pramac Ducati. That's a hot one.
What do you think the odds of that could happen?
I think it's real because I never thought Jorge would gel with the Honda, and the Honda is obviously a difficult bike to ride, and there's only one person on the planet who can actually ride it and ride it fast, and that's Marc Marquez. And I thought Honda would learn something from Lorenzo's style and build a motorcycle that Jorge could adapt to and make a more friendly motorcycle, because if the motorcycle's friendly, even Cal Crutchlow can win on it. And he's done that, and he loves the 2018 bike, but he hates the 2019 bike. So this doesn't surprise me that Jorge wants out of Honda. The fact that he's going back to Ducati surprises me. You kind of think he would want to go towards a Yamaha bike, right? But there really isn't any room at the inn, because I don't see... Rossi's not going anywhere. Until Rossi decides he's going to hang up the leathers, Rossi's going to ride on a Yamaha.
Right.
So you have Vinales, who essentially is the heir apparent to Rossi in Yamaha. He's got a tight contract. He's not going anywhere, and they look like they're actually making some progress. So maybe like the Petronas Sprinta team, right?
Could be.
Maybe Jorge's trying to go there. Well, what do you have there? You've got Quartararo.
Sure.
So no way, no how is Quartararo getting replaced. Morbidelli? I wouldn't get rid of Morbidelli. Because, I mean, think about it. For the price that you're going to pay for Morbidelli versus the price that you may have to pay for Lorenzo. Now, we know that Lorenzo was rumored to have signed for only 700,000 euros to ride for Honda. So is he cutting Pramac a deal to prove that he can still race and win? Does he have a guarantee that he has a 2019 or a 2020 bike at Pramac? Because Miller has a 2019 Ducati, right?
That's right.
So does that mean? Does that mean Miller is leaving Pramac and going to the factory team? And Petrucci's out? I wouldn't give up Danilo. I mean, I think his contract is signed, sealed, and delivered, right? He wanted Mugello.
That's right.
Italian on Italian bike on Italian circuit.
Yeah.
So I think he's safe. But there's more to this. There's more underlying to this at some point. And like I've said a million times before with Lorenzo, this was never going to work at Honda. It was never going to be this big Marquez versus Lorenzo battle that was going to be like the epic Senna Prost battles in Formula One. It was just never going to happen. The riding style was just nowhere near compatible to the way that Honda was actually going to work. So,
well, and I think I'd agree with you too on that. I think from a personal perspective, I just disappointed, I think, with watching Lorenzo. And granted, he's been injured for the majority of the season. I'd like to see a little more fight out of him and a little more clean air to race in, so to speak.
Well, we shall see. It is only a rumor, but we know how rumors are at silly season. Where there's smoke, there's fire. So, and with that, let us get on to actually the Brno race. So the qualifying sessions on Saturday were done in the rain. The forecast was for rain on Saturday, and it lived up to it. So when Moto3 took to the track, we actually had a pretty wet session. Interesting take in the QP1 was the fact that we had Fernandez, Arenas, Kornfeld, and Foggia, and Binder were all in this QP1 session. This is kind of becoming the norm. These are the guys that were kind of sussed out. We kind of see they're usually in there. What was very interesting to me in the first session was the fact that the Anchu twins were both out together. Mm-hmm. Chan let out his brother Denise in the first session. Kind of needy, looked back, looked at him, like waved his arm, like, come on, buddy, we got to go. It's good to see the brothers together again. There's a lot of pressure on these two Turkish kids to perform. And with this rain, I really thought Chan was going to have a really great chance at least going through in the first session, because he was so good in the rain and tricky conditions in Valencia when he won the race. I just expected a whole heck of a lot out of him in that one. But really, he really didn't disappoint. He did go through, but he did crash on his last flying lap, and we were waiting the time out to see if he would actually make it through. And by the skin of his teeth, he did, because Arenas did just miss out and did not get into the first session. So at a QP1, we had the first four guys here, which was Fernandez, Yurchenko, the Kazakhstan rider, was second. Lopez was your third, Anchu there. And because of Arenas just missing out, he doesn't go in, and that leaves Anchu in there. So that was QP1 for Moto3. In QP2 for Moto3, we find out that Rodrigo cannot ride this weekend because he has a broken collarbone and a broken pelvis. A fractured pelvis, sorry, and a broken collarbone. He was sent back to Spain to be operated on. No word when he was going to be back yet, and I haven't found anything out yet on that. Of note in QP2 was the fact that De La Porta's bike had problems again. This is now the second time they've had problems with the bike. Don't know what it is. It appeared by what from the camera pictures that it was like the bike was stuck in gear, or the gearbox was broken, because the team was frantically prying on the shifter and working down in that area of the motorcycle for it. So De La Porta didn't even get a time in the session. He was going to start 18th, I think, because he couldn't set a time. But we had Fernandez, who had a big old high side, tossed himself off there on it. Arbolino just got faster and absolutely faster and faster and faster as he went through. Every time somebody else went faster, Arbolino went faster, which was interesting. But Arbolino's teammate, Fanati, nowhere to be found again. Now, here we are again, a guy who is in the wet, really good, won Misano a couple of years ago. The reason I know that is because I waxed poetic about how he was riding there at that time. He went on to win in Japan on an absolutely typhoon-drenched racetrack. So, hey, Fanati should be at the front of these qualifying sessions. He wasn't. He was way down the list. Fanati eventually wound up finishing a qualifying in 11th place. Not where I expected to see Fanati, right? You wouldn't think he would be there, especially with Arbolino looking so good. I mean, like I said, Arbolino was just faster, faster, and faster, and couldn't get anywhere.
Incredible.
And so we had all that. And Ramirez, he was also off the pace as well. That is De La Porta's teammate. They both were down there at 17th and 18th. So with qualifying finishing off, we had Arbolino went to pole on his Honda. McPhee was there on Honda and second. Antonelli was your third fastest man. Tazuki Suzuki, and on the fourth position, Raul Fernandez, Aaron Canet. Canet did not have the best of qualifying sessions there, but he was definitely in the hunt. He was the second fastest of the KTMs. Again, horsepower track. Honda's had motor over top of KTM all year long. So Canet being down there really didn't surprise me, but Canet wasn't really visible in the session at all. He wasn't setting any kind of fast times. He wasn't doing any kind of fast sectors. So definitely like a quiet start to the weekend for Canet. So Canet was in the sixth position on the second row. Then you had Yurchenko, who came out of that first session, and he was riding incredibly well in the rain. Mm-hmm. Very smooth, definitely had things going his way. So maybe this is sort of that like breakthrough kind of thing that we're looking for out of Yurchenko. He's been close a couple times. He was followed across by Masia, and then finally you had Orgaga there in ninth. So there's how it finished off. Your top 10 being finished out by Lopez. So that was the qualifying session for Moto 3. So we'll do this in order, and we'll go next to MotoGP so that we can keep track of the weather issues. So it actually started to rain a little bit more during during the FP4 session for the MotoGP bikes. When they first went out, it was definitely very wet, and it was all about wet tires for that FP4 session. But a drying line was developing. The big bikes, big horsepower, were definitely starting to create a drying line. So in the first session, we have no surprises. We have everybody who's there, his people who should be in that first session. We didn't have Dovizioso in the session. We didn't have Rossi in this session. We had the KTMs, we expect that. And we had Takaki Nakagami in there, and Brattle on the other Honda, and we had the Aprilias there. So as this, there was a drying line, so everybody kind of went out and just kept pounding in the laps over and over and over again. Gintoli, who was wild carding on the Suzuki, was at the top for a little bit. He looked pretty good on it. Again, wet race, they changes everything. So as it goes along, Zarco winds up being one of the fastest guys out of the session. Absolutely amazing, that Zarco. I mean, again, rain, Zarco's very smooth, very fluid kind of a rider, kind of like almost a perfect storm situation going on there with Zarco. Pol Espargaró was also fast. They were both there looking really good. But the thing was for me was Zarco, how confident he looked on the bike. He really seemed as though he maybe had found something with the bike. And he was starting to, you know, you could kind of tell just by his body language on the bike that he was starting to get along with his KTM, which is not really that easy of a bike to get along with. I think if you put Marquez on the bike, it would work, right? Because that bike is about as wobbly and shaky and quaky as the Honda. But as the session died out, you actually had Zarco finishing first, and the second man was Pol Espargaró. So the two KTMs go out of the first session into the second session. So as we start out, we've got an even drier line that's happening now. And everybody first goes out on wet tires. Everybody's running around. They're trying to kind of find their groove of where they're actually going to go. And at the beginning, Zarco was looking quick. He had the experience. He knew where the water was. Espargaró was sort of right there with him. Miller was running fast. Rins was running fast. So, and then you had sort of Vinales and Quartararo kind of falling along there. But they were all kind of bunched up in a little bit of a group. And so you had Marquez, who was on Reigns. And they're getting to the Kevin Schwantz corner, which I think is like, 13, 12, 11, like the turn 10 area. And Marquez was trying to go up the inside of like Miller and kind of run with him. And Marquez couldn't find the gap or the emptiness on the racetrack that he wanted. So he sort of slowed on the racing line a little bit. To which Rins runs up the inside of him at 13. At 11, and kind of roughs him up a little bit, right? Hey, buddy, I'm trying to have a fast lap, and you're on the fast line, and I want to be there kind of a thing. So they kind of go on, and well, Marquez has none of that, so Marquez just kind of gives it right back again, and he does it as they're diving in to go into the pits. So Marquez dives inside Rins, kind of sets him up. They roll off into the pits. There's a bit of posturing between Marquez and Rins, if you will. If eyes were laser beams, they would have looked like Superman trying to like X-ray each other or something, because you know there was some words being said under the helmets. They rode back into the pits together, side by side, and as you go into the pit lane, there's a wall of tires that kind of juts out in the lane, and you see Marquez reach over with his left hand, put it on Rins's right thigh, and sort of shove him in the bike over so that Marquez has enough room to go through and get into the pits as well. So Marquez then goes in and they park the bike and he gets out and gets ready to go on to a bike that has slick tires on it. Ballsy Marquez move, which is sort of what Marquez does in these situations, right?
Absolutely.
If anyone's going to go out on slicks and potentially set a fast lap on this thing, it was going to be him, right? That's just how it was going to be. So Marquez gets out there. In the meantime, Zarco is still pounding out laps. He's still fast up front. And then Marquez is going out on slicks. Well, that sort of sets everybody in motion to go on slicks, because then Rins goes to slicks, Miller comes out on slicks, everything happens. So Marquez goes back on track. He's like 2 seconds slower than anything else, but it's the first lap, and he's trying to get the tires warmed up. He goes around again on his second flying lap, and at this time, he's starting to set fast sectors. So through the first sector, quickest. Second sector, quickest. Third sector, quickest. He's flying. Okay, Marquez has pulled the master stroke that everybody does, but what happens? It's now raining in the fourth sector, so turns 11, 12, 13, and 14 are now being recoated with water, and Marquez is on slicks, and I'm like, how hard is it raining? Because if he's got enough heat in the slicks, it's not going to matter that much. He's going to be able to get through this. He's probably going to get to pole. It's going to be close because he's going to have to slow up some for the water, right? Mm. But Marquez does the unthinkable, and I don't think he let off. I don't think he didn't tiptoe it. He rode through those last three turns of the track where there was no dry line. It was definitely wet. You could see the water coming, the sheen, on his slicks, and he runs through to pole.
Incredible.
Absolutely incredible by Marquez. I mean, you know, absolutely phenomenal deal there. Okay, he's got pole. I'm thinking, stop, park it. But he doesn't. He's got enough. He's in under the time. So he's got one more flying lap. He's faster through the first sector again than his own previous time. He's faster in the second sector again. He's faster in third sector again. Right? Like, what the hell are you doing? Because it's raining harder now in the final section of the track. And Marquez, again, I thought, well, okay, fine. He's just running the tires in. He's just going to pull up here at the end and just kind of coast through and go back to the pits. No. Marquez goes flying through the last two turns again. I have never seen anybody on slicks exhibit the kind of control that Mark did. There's a photo on a high-speed camera that they showed of him almost dragging his knee on slicks with a rooster tail of water coming off of the slicks. If you don't think this isn't one of the most amazing qualifying laps you've ever seen, I'll quote you Matt Oxley's tweet. I am officially gobsmacked at Mark Marquez's lap. And that lap gave him pole by a huge margin. It was really what it was. And he was, at that point, 2.5 seconds faster than Miller. Now, Miller, to tell you how treacherous the conditions were, Miller actually falls on slicks and wasn't able to complete his last flying lap. But the bravest of the brave, Johann Zarco, who stayed on reins the whole entire time, actually gets on the front row on the KTM. Absolutely amazing ride by Zarco. So we'll run down the qualifying order. Marquez on pole by 2.5 seconds on what is truly a lap of the gods. I haven't seen a qualifying lap like that since maybe Kio Rio. I don't know if it was a World Superbike or British Superbike from Donington, when the bike was absolutely sideways, left, right, center on a rain lap, which is absolutely incredible. Go look it up on YouTube, people. Miller was second. Johann Zarco third. KTM's first front row start. Dovizioso, Espargaro. Now Dovizioso played the wild card spoiler part in that pretty well, because he actually went back out on medium rain tires, because everybody started with the soft rains. Dovi went back out on the drying line with the medium rains and wound up there in, where was that? And Dovi was fourth. And then Espargaro on the KTM, then Rins, Rossi, Petrucci, Vinales, Quartararo, Crutchlow, and Morbidelli are your top 12 in there. That was an incredible qualifying session. The interesting thing happens after the qualifying session, because Rins gets angry, is still angry over the whole Marquez incident, and starts tweeting that Marquez has no respect for any other rider on the track. Like, oh, okay, let's just make the, I mean, I love the aggression from Rins, but the thing of it was, here was the problem. Marquez was slow on a racing line. Rins did bump him off in what was a pretty good amount of contact. He brushed him up pretty hard. Then Marquez gets red mist and kind of does Rins dirty at the end of that lap as they go into the pits. But then Rins goes dirty again because he's not going to leave Marquez like really enough room to actually get into the pits because of the tire wall. Race direction took no action on any of this. They felt like there was not anything that happened in there at all that was worthy of being penalized. So I gotta ask you, was Rins right? Should Marquez have been penalized? Where do you fall on this one, Joel?
That's a good question. I think you look at he's in a spot on the racetrack where he's pushing, he's trying to get his hot lap going. But, you know, at the same token, the track is not particularly dry. So I could see both sides. In this particular case, you know, I think Rins could be in the right here to some degree, but I also could see Marquez as well. I just think it's an unfortunate circumstance it had during the qualifying.
Yeah, I don't know which way to call this. At this point, I'm not envying Freddie Spencer at all.
No.
Because I don't know how I would call it. If it was a truly dry racetrack and Marquez did what he did, he needs to be penalized in some way. Because that's putting on the racing line.
Yeah, I would agree.
I think because it was wet / drying, that there was really only one line. That line was one motorcycle wide. You know, Rins did get by. And if Rins had continued on that lap, maybe they might have done something to Marquez. But Rins had no intention of taking that lap as a banker lap and then coming in later and switching to bikes.
Good point.
Because they all went to the pits together. Yep. It wasn't like, if Rins had taken off and left everybody and tried to make a big lap out of it and qualify on that lap, I think there's more validity to his...
Yep.
To an argument that Marquez needs to be penalized.
Absolutely.
But because they all went to the pits at the same time, they were all equally slowing, or were equally slow getting back to the pits. So I'm okay with it, provided that, you know, if Rins had gone on, then, okay, we need to do something about Marquez. Now, is Marquez, more to the point now, is, okay, let's go back and analyze it. Is Marquez an irresponsible rider? Does he not care about anybody else that's on the racetrack? I don't know. I mean, I think all of these guys have a bit of an ego, or else you wouldn't actually be where you are, and you wouldn't be as good as you are, because self-belief in what you can do is important in this important characteristic that happens here. Rossi doesn't really like riding with Marquez. That was evident from the Sepang incident that we really shouldn't ever mention again. But there's a point where, you know, I think Marquez is aggressive and he takes no quarter. But isn't that what we all love about racing? You know, I don't want to see everybody rule out that we can't touch or bump everybody. I mean, here in America, we've got NASCAR, which is big saloons running around on racetracks, and these guys barely touch one another, and somebody's crying and whining about, hey, he hit me, or he bumped me. I mean, guys, you're sitting there in a car with a roll cage around you. Stop whining. So, you know, there's always going to be haters of Marquez. I'm firmly in the camp. I'm firmly a Marquez fan. I fully admit that. Was he in the wrong? No, not by the letter of the law. That's what happened right then. However, I hope that maybe Freddie Spencer went and did a talk with him behind the scenes, which if he did, we probably would have heard about it, but maybe he didn't. But that would have been nice. Say, hey, look, you know, what you did is on the verge of being a problem. I don't really want to see that attitude out of you again on the racetrack. So, but that is how qualifying filled out for MotoGP. So we'll move on to Moto2 qualifying. Now, Moto2 qualifying, we're just now still have that track that has, the rain has stopped again. So this on-again, off-again rain thing has stopped. And we have a lot of wetness there that's in the turn, the final couple of turns of the track. So the first session goes out. You had Gardner in that session. You had Bezzecchi, Pacini, and Martin. You had Joel Roberts in there. He had a big high side at turn 13, which, again, Joel Roberts, I expected a lot out of him. He's done very well on races that were rain races, and you saw it when he hit the ground and he got back up. You could see it in his face. You could tell he knew he had an opportunity to actually do something really good this weekend, but it didn't work. Again, Joel picks up, or Joe Roberts, not Joel. Joel is my friend. Joe is the guy riding the bike. Joe Roberts picks the bike up, and again, the Triumph won't start. Every time somebody puts a Triumph on the ground, they do not start again. So this is becoming a thing. So Triumph, again, did not restart. It was there. So as it ran out, Gardner, Bowman Schneider, Dixon, Bezzecchi, and Martin, those four riders move on to it. Joe Roberts, who had to work, who could not get his bike to restart, had to see where he was going to wind up. He wound up falling all the way down to sixth in that session, so he wasn't able to go on. So now the track has dried out a little bit more, and we're kind of looking like the track looked like when we had the end of first MotoGP qualifying. We have a pretty distinct dry line that's now appeared pretty much everywhere in the track. So as QP2 starts off, everybody goes out on wets. Bezzecchi is the quickest guy. Bowman Schneider goes down. But then Marquez and Bezzecchi whip off into the pits. Now, there aren't two bikes in Moto2. You have one bike. I'm like, what's the thought process here, guys? They actually stopped and changed to slicks. So Bezzecchi and Marquez go for slicks. So Marquez then goes out, again, in not as sketchy as conditions as what Mark actually was out in, but again, a conditions that may not have been optimum for a slick, and goes out there and runs off some good laps. Now, Lowe's was actually the first guy in, so he actually was the first guy back out on slicks. He winds up going to pole, because obviously the track is now good for slicks. So then DJ Antonio went to pole, because he was on the slicks, because a lot of guys had tried to change. And then finally, on the last lap, last gasp, down to the wire, Alex Marquez takes pole position, just like his brother does, on slicks. And what was a really good ride for him in the Moto, on Moto 2. He was on pole, he was followed by Lowe's, and then Baldessari. And I believe Baldessari still had wets on the bike at the time. But it was as if Alex had watched exactly what his big brother had did and did the exact same thing. And Alfox sort of, you know, made the right call to get onto the slick tire at that time and go on to be fast and be on pole. But the rain wasn't really going to matter, because there was no forecast for rain as we got into race day on Sunday. So Moto3 is a completely dry race, bright sunshine, beautiful day at the track at Brno. Antonelli's bike stalls on the grid. He can't get off the grid. So he gets pushed off, and he's going to have to start from pit lane. Arbolino got the whole shot and was gone, but McPhee's bike stalled. Everyone got by him until the very end, when the Japanese rider, Kuni banged into the side of McPhee. Basically knocked the exhaust system askew, knocked the foot peg off the bike, and eventually John had to be helped from the motorcycle, and he was taken to the infield care center, and they were looking at whether he had any fractures to his lower left leg or to his shoulder or anything. But that is the worst thing, to be on the front row and your bike stall, or you don't get away like you think you're going to get away. And John was doing the right thing. He had his hand up. He was trying to signal everybody that was behind him. But if you watch it from the helicopter, you can see that Kuni was completely unsighted. He had no chance. He just wrong place at the wrong time. So that was like the actual start of it. Then it got down to where it became like a literal crash fest for the next three or four laps, because Salak went down at turn two on the very first lap. That caused his teammate Kornfeld to run into through the gravel trap. Vietti, he went down at turn nine. Tom Booth Amos went down at turn 10. Suzuki was then down at turn 13 on a high side. That was another brutal high side. And you almost asked yourself, like, is there going to be any Moto 3 guys left at all? Because everybody was falling. It was a dry track, guys. I mean, it was, everybody's excited to be back from the break, I guess. So it was definitely crazy for that. So things kind of settled out here. You had Arbolino and Fanati were out front. You had Lopez there with Fernandez. And Canet was doing the usual Canet thing. He was in that 6, 7, 8 spot early on, kind of just holding into it right there. But the cool part was that we had Della Porta, who was 18th, had only made his way to 14th by 16 laps to go. So like in a couple laps, he'd only gained like 4 places. He kind of thought that Della Porta would have just blown through the pack, really, because we've seen Della Porta be at the front the last 2-3 races. He's definitely got the talent. But that was where Della Porta was. We had Rossi fall at turn 10. Arenas went down at turn 7. Again, we kind of went back to this we're going to go crash stuff thing. But the front battle was still really pretty good. It was Fanati. It was Arbolino. It was Lopez. It was Fernandez. It was a classic Moto3 race. These guys were just completely going back and forth. They were leading a little bit, weren't leading a little bit. It was really, really good racing that was out in the front. But the people of interest was Canet, still doing his thing, right? He's been that 6th spot, roughly. Della Porta, by this time, had made his way to about 10th. And Antonelli from the pits was 16th. Now, Antonelli was setting fast lap after fast lap after fast lap after fast lap. And I'm going, is he going to be able to get to the end of the race with his tires? Because you can't really run that fast. And once he actually hit track, he was like a second faster than everybody on track until he hit traffic, and then he dropped off by like a second to a second and a half a lap, which is that's an amazing statistic to me, that when you put all the Moto 3 bikes together in a pack, you can lose about a second and a half.
It's incredible.
Per lap. That's absolutely phenomenal to me in there. When we had 10 to go, we had Masia, Fernandez, and Arbolino there. Now, Fanati had kind of fallen back a little bit. Now, I really thought that Fanati was going to do really well here because he loves that big, swoopy line. And if there's any track at all that this is going to work on, it's got to be Brno, because I think Brno is the widest track at 40 meters. I believe it's 40 meters wide. I think Sepang is like 33 or 35 meters wide, or maybe I've got it backwards, but they're like... Those are the only tracks where Fanati's really funky wide lines will actually work. And I really thought it was going to work, but it didn't seem to want to work. So it was uncertain as to what was going on. But as the guys came down the main straightaway, Della Porta got a huge draft and went from 10th to pretty much first in the shape of one corner. The guy's a demon on the brakes, for sure. Masia got sucked in with everybody there on that turn one and then he kind of ran wide. So sort of his race ran there. And he then sort of gave up. Let me rephrase that. He got sucked in there to turn one. He kind of botched it, kind of bumped around a few people, pushed them out, so they kind of ran wide. They were all on the track. But he put his hand up immediately, kind of got out of the way, and let about three or four guys go back by, because I think he knew the stewards would probably look at that and be like, yeah, that was a little questionable. I wouldn't have done anything. That's racing. I've ridden miles. I've ridden road racing. You can get sucked in there farther than what you think, and you can go, and in your mind, you say, I know I've got this draft off three or four bikes, and okay, I'm going to grab the brake lever just a little bit early. And you do, and you are pulling with it for all you're worth, but your bike's not slowing down because the vacuum that you're in is just sucking you along. That brakes are basically useless. So I even if he had not given those places back, I would not have made him give them back if I was in the stewarding room. But things got really interesting when we got like to two to go, because it was Arbolino was out front, because he had made up all the time Arbolino was there the whole time. Sorry. Arbolino, Antonelli, I get those two backwards in my head all the time. Sorry, folks. Didn't mean to cause you to go crazy on there. No, Arbolino was out front. Cannon had now worked his way to second. Della Porta was there. He had Masia. Darren Binder was there. Lopez, Antonelli, and Fanati with seven to go. By five to go, Toba was down. He had got together and had a bad tumble. It was really scary looking because the bike kind of came with him. And I thought, you know, just make sure that wasn't going to be really nasty. Just bad looking crash. Lopez had went down and got caught up in a crash. So they all went down. They were in the gravel. Then he wound up with, He was down with a Garcia. So Garcia and Lopez go down, and basically Lopez got back up and kind of pushed Garcia into the guardrail. A little red mist there, which I'm pretty sure there's going to be some kind of penalty ensued on that, because that is completely unacceptable in my book. If he doesn't get a penalty, he should get a penalty, because that was really not acceptable at all. And there really wasn't a clear indication of actually who was at fault in the accident. So even at that, by looking at what the views that I had of it, it was pretty much a racing incident. So all said and done. Finally, down to the very end of it all, Della Porta, Arbolino, Antonelli, who had come from the pit lane, is now running third. Absolutely incredible. Canet still doing what Canet does. He's running back in about fourth. And then we get down to the last lap, and it just goes all crazy. Canet starts to make his move. Antonelli gets swallowed up. Della Porta kind of goes to the front there for a little bit. It's kind of crazy, but Canet has now made it to the front. He puts a great move on at Schwantz at 10. He pulls a smallest of gap. Canet started to go to the front through the first two sectors, through sectors 2 and 3. He was at the front, was pulling ahead, putting a gap on everybody in what would later turn to be an absolute masterstroke of genius. All the Hondas behind him decide to fight it out from Schwantz on up Horsepower Hill instead of getting behind Canet and drafting him. And Canet actually winds up winning the race. Never led a lap but the last one, which is the only lap you need to lead. Great race by Canet to win the race. Della Porta came home second. Arbolino was third. Masia fourth. Antonelli was fifth. So an absolutely great race by those guys. I mean, I don't really know who to give ride of the race to. I'm not sure if it should have been Canet, because he only led the lap that was important, the last one. He outfoxed and outplayed everybody on a Honda to win on a KTM. Or do I give it to Antonelli, who went from the pit lane to fourth and was actually leading the race and had a chance at winning? So, I mean, that's how crazy of a Moto 3 race
incredible
there was in that. So I'm going to give it to both guys for ride of the race, because that was absolutely phenomenal for that part of it.
So Jim, we end off, what, Moto 3 World Standings then?
Yes, Moto 3 World Standings, please. Run it down.
Starting off, Aaron Canet at 148 points, leading number two, De La Porta, by 3 points, and at number three, Antonelli.
Yeah, so their drop-off is after that. Really, it's a two-rider race for the World Championship in Moto 3. It is between De La Porta and Canet.
That's right.
And I don't know who is going to take that one, but that is going to be an absolute barn burner of a championship to watch. These two guys are really pretty equal. I think De La Porta is a little more ragged of a rider and doesn't quite have the strategy part of things figured out as much as Canet does, but they're the yin and the yang against each other, and it's going to be absolutely, we're going to go to tracks where the Honda is going to be a superior motorcycle, we're going to go to other tracks where the KTMs are going to be a superior motorcycle. It is going to be fabulous to watch that. Anything else we want to talk about from Moto 3? I think that pretty much gets it. Shall we go to Moto 2?
Let's do it.
All right, Moto 2. So, the Moto 2 race, basically lows, high sides, and crashes. Yes, I know, Skylar, lows down again. Marquez basically got out front, and he ran off with it. He pretty much just pulled away lap after lap after lap. He was in the zone. He was in a place where nobody else could touch him. The only issue I had was he was running so hard at the beginning of that race that I had to have believed were his tires going to be of use to him when he later on in the session. It was crazy because then you had DG Antonio actually got a great start on the speed up. Navarra had the bad start on the speed up, which is kind of normal. But, I mean, Vierge, he was down at turn six. But Marquez literally had a 1 second, he had 8/10 of a second, almost a full second over DG Antonio. And the thing of it is, DG Antonio was trying to stay with him. And I thought for sure Marquez was going to kind of burn up the tires. We know the speed up is a very good tire, or very good on tires. It has a great edge grip at the end. And I thought maybe DG Antonio was going to be able to, like, hang with him. But Marquez just kept putting time on him, lap after lap after lap. Luthi was 10th. He was nowhere this weekend. I mean, Luthi wasn't anywhere in qualifying. We didn't talk about him. There wasn't anything happening with him during the race. It was actually terrible.
Completely disappointing.
Yeah, I mean, it was weird. He had Binder. He went from 16th to 8th, and he had the whole new KTM chassis. But this is like the first time that they've been able to like run that chassis, so it's like there's really no testing on it. But he seems to think that they've taken the chatter out of the bike, so that should be better. So I was looking for Binder to make a run towards the front. You know, Schroeder was pressuring Lowe's until, you know, Lowe's crashes, and then of all shocks, Luthi crashed.
Unreal.
I mean, Luthi is not a rider who actually crashes. He doesn't, and he did. And he just lost the front of that turn 5, turn 6 area in there. And then, you know, we get back to the front. It's Marquez and DG Antonio. They're now got a 3-second lead over Schroeder there. Lowe's then went down at that point in the race. Navarro, he's started to come from behind. He made his way to 5th with 11 to go. By 7 to go, Navarro had gotten to 4th. He was trying to run down everybody at the front. He eventually got his way to 3rd. From there, basically, you had like Balassari and Bastianini was 4th. He was trying to close down on Navarro. He was trying, couldn't really get there. But basically, when it came down to the end of the race, Alex wins the race, had everybody covered. So he won with after Mark was DG Antonio, sorry, got confused in which speed up was where. Then Bastianini, who had gotten Navarro back by Navarro, winds up there at the end. So that was your podium for the Moto 3 race. Again, superlatives to Alex Marquez because it was one of the better rides that he's put on. He has won 4 of the last 5 Moto 2 races, which is
incredible.
Absolutely amazing. He looks like his brother. He has form and talent to spare against everybody else in the pit lane right now. Should Marquez get a MotoGP ride? I don't know. I mean, he's proven that he's actually got the goods now. I mean, for whatever reason, something has just completely clicked, and that's kind of where it is.
He's looked strong the last 4 or 5 weeks for sure.
I won't doubt you on that one. It's just trying to figure out, like, what he has or doesn't have. So, the thing of it was, too, is that, Navarro's got to figure out how to actually get off the line. Because DG Antonio got off the line fine. But, they couldn't. KTM is still completely, messed up. I mean, they've missed this one so bad. I don't know how that happened, but it's pretty much what happened. And that's just kind of how it's going right now. Is it a case that Marquez is really that much better than everybody, or is everything just going Marquez's way right now? It's kind of, I guess, what I'm trying to say, long way around on that one. But with the Moto2 World Championships, Alex Marquez increases his points lead. He has now on 161 points, leading Luthi by 128 points. And then Augusto Fernandez is third, Jorge Navarro fourth, Schroeder fifth, and Baldassare sixth in the championship. It is definitely Alex Marquez's championship to lose, and if he keeps racking up wins like this, no one is going to be able to touch him.
Well, and I can't help but to think, could this, if this noise we're hearing with Lorenzo potentially leaving Honda, could that open?
You're gonna feed the fire that I have that both Marquezes are gonna ride on a Honda.
It's possible. I think
I don't know about that.
And maybe it's
too. I'd love to see it, but I don't think it's gonna happen.
I would too. But maybe it's premature for Alex, but to be even running MotoGP yet. But I just think
he's been in Moto2 for a number of years. It's just he's never been able to consistently ride at the front and consistently win. Yeah. And, that's one of the things that, if Marquez was winning this championship because he was finishing on the podium week in, week out, that would be one thing. But he's leading this championship because he has been winning week in and week out.
Right.
And, pretty much that's how it goes.
Well, and Luthi didn't help himself either.
Luthi did himself absolutely no favors whatsoever. So let's get to MotoGP. Probably not the best race of the year. But let's set the stage. Basically, as the podium ceremony for Moto2 is happening, it buckets down rain. But it only really buckets down rain in the first sector on the racetrack. So basically, the last couple turns plus the first turn and the main straightaway. After that, it's all completely dry. So the MotoGP bikes go off for their siding lap. Everybody's on wets, and they find out the track is basically dry. So there becomes this consternation as to, like, well, should we be on slicks? Should we be on wets? What should we do? What shouldn't we do? There's a lot of discussion, a lot of talk about, well, now it's not safe because I need a wet to get through the first part of the circuit because it's so wet. I can't ride it on a slick. But we can't run wets because if we do, then the wets are going to give up, and that becomes potentially unsafe because we're going to destroy the wets on the dry section of the track. And if you got overcooked wet, it's not going to give you any traction in the actual wet areas that you're looking for. So it was about 40 minutes of wait as we tried to figure out exactly what we were going to do. The rain had quit, the track was drying, and basically we got to go into a quick start procedure. So basically everybody had to get out of the pit lane within a minute. Everybody went out on slicks. Marquez actually had the typical hard front, and he had the soft rear, which, and given the conditions, you thought maybe he might have taken a medium or something, but he didn't. Basically, it was softs all around for everybody on the back, and then, Honda's on the hard, Yamaha's on the mediums, Ducati's on the mediums, etc. for tires. So the quick start procedure happens. We get out of the pits. We get everybody onto the grid. We take the one siding. We take the one warm-up lap. We come back. We hit the lights, and Zarco goes backwards on the KTM. He was starting on the wettest part of the racetrack, for sure. That doesn't help anything. And so he wound up going backwards. Marquez got a great hole shot. Dovizioso, always with a fantastic hole shot. Hole shot device on the KTM. Hole shot device working on the Ducati very well. They were followed by Miller, Rins, and Espargaro. Now, Mir and Morbidelli are down. Zarco was into... He was sort of the victim of that crash of Mir and Morbidelli. Didn't look real well. Rins got Miller at turn three, so it was a bit there. But basically, the race was pretty much at that point, it was over. Nobody was really going to touch Marquez at that point. I mean, he was doing his thing on his track. And what was interesting is he just sort of, he eked away at it. He just kept adding a second here, a second there, a tenth of a second here, tenth of a second there. He was riding well within himself. He kind of got to a point where he started to drop the hammer. He put some distance on Dovizioso, tried to break his back. Dovizioso rode an absolutely fine race. There was really nothing wrong with how Dovizioso rode. He just didn't have the pace that Marquez had on it. Miller wound up actually finishing third, being on the podium, which is a great result for Miller.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how many times have we wanted Miller to be on a podium? Mm-hmm. But it's kind of Miller's conditions, right? It was sort of a tricky track. We had an area that was kind of wet, and he's done well. He won Assen in the rain. Miller kind of does well in the rain with everyone. The Ducks go well in the rain. But that was the thing that got me. Was admittedly, it was not a rain race at all, but it was definitely wet enough to give you some concern at the very beginning on slicks. You know, those are the kind of conditions that you really would have expected the Ducatis to do really, really well in, given their previous history. But they kind of didn't. They just kind of stagnated there. But still, it was a great ride for Miller. It was great to see him on the podium. Rins couldn't deal with Miller. The Suzuki definitely just doesn't have enough horsepower to get there. And Rins basically used up all of his tires trying to maintain corner speed to hang with the Ducatis out front. Again, we got horsepower hill. The Suzuki was definitely getting pulled probably one and a half bike lengths maybe. But the other interesting thing to me was that the Ducati had absolutely nothing on the Honda. I would have expected the Ducati to still have gone past, have been able to keep Marquez in sight.
Yeah.
And they did, but those two bikes seem to be even in horsepower going up the hill. The Honda seems to have just as much as what the Ducati has. So, you know, again, fair play for that one there. But that was, you know, we go down the list, we look, Crutchlow kind of came through the pack. Yeah. He wound up finishing fifth. Difficult conditions, sort of Cal kind of rides to the top. You know, give him any time that there's trickiness, he tends to be there. Rossi had a good ride. He was actually sixth, which was not bad, considering we hadn't talked about Rossi at all, or really any of the Yamahas at all in this race. The Yamahas basically went belly up again. I don't know what's going on with, you know, Rossi was sort of in his familiar sixth. He can't seem to get it to go any better than that. Vinales had a really bad start, went backwards as he usually does. Now suddenly he's, you know, I thought the Yamahas would have been better here. They had tracks like Assen and Sachsenring where they can use the edge of the tire and they looked good, and you thought Yamaha might be getting somewhere here. Maybe we found the secret sauce. We've got a different suspension link. We've got something maybe to help. And we're right back to where we were. This looks like the Yamahas at the beginning of the year. Would you agree? Or?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's
disappointing.
Yeah. And, you know, the whole time, we know the Yamaha must be decent because Quartararo has looked fantastic in the last few races. Again, you know, Quartararo looked good from Spain onward, basically. And he was looking good when the factory Yamahas weren't looking good. But we got to Brno, we got to the rain. First time he's kind of ridden a MotoGP bike in the rain. That has got to be one of the craziest feelings in the world to try to do. I can't imagine trying to keep 240, 250 horsepower glued to the pavement with it being rainy like that, or at least questionable conditions that you don't know what kind of grip you're going to get. So Quartararo being in seventh, I am not going to be disappointed with his finish. I would have hoped for him to have been a little bit higher, but he did the best that he could.
Yep.
and that's really all that you could ask for him. He took it as a learning experience. The other guy that does well in the rain, Petrucci, he was really nowhere. You know, all week he finished eighth. You know, Dovizioso shaded him big time, which I would have thought, you know, Petrucci would have been closer to the front, but wasn't. Then yet the woe of the KTMs continue because Zarco went backwards. He wound up 14th, couldn't put anything together. He went back to looking like the bad Zarco of before. I really had hope for Zarco to finish better than he did. I had no delusions that Zarco was going to finish in the top five or maybe even the top 10, but I would have thought he would have been close to the top 10. I would have put Zarco in for like a 9-10 spot, maybe 9-10-11.
Sure.
It never materialized. Zarco looked horrid. But, you know, Pol was right there at 11th. That's kind of where I expect KTM to be with him. Maybe just a skosh higher. You know, other than that, you know, Bridle was the real thing. Bridle was nowhere to be found, which goes to prove that the only person who can ride a Honda really is Mark Marquez. So... And then, you know, and then Gintley finished, you know, 20th on the ride, on the one-off wild card ride for Suzuki. So that gets us to the championship standings like we really need to know. But Marquez is now on 210 points to Dovizioso's 147. You can pretty much start engraving Mark's name into the trophy this year, I think. Unless something drastic changes between now and then, no one's going to beat Marquez. And the thing that got me about Marquez was they talked to him after and he said he put too much risk into qualifying. That's a really scary thought. He now understands where too much risk is. So here's a kid that's 26 years old. He is, in my mind, getting stronger and better every week. He's riding well within himself because he hasn't crashed a motorcycle since... Coda.
It's been a while.
Since Coda. Wow. Since Coda, he's been either first or second in every race. That's an impressive statistic.
Well, and to some extent, too, I think when you look at how he rides, I feel like his 90% can beat the field's 100% right now. Or maybe 95%, what have you. But the point is, he's just off in a different world.
Somehow Marquez has figured out how to elevate himself yet again. And I don't know if he's exactly elevated himself so much as he's figured out how to rein himself in. He has now figured out how to ride within Mark Marquez. I will say this about Marquez. I noticed this during the race. He had the one major moment on the front. Kind of got the feet off the pegs. You know, it's that Marquez moment where the front's gone. He picks it up on the elbow, gets it all back together again, and rides in control. And I noticed that at that point, and I don't know if it's just, maybe it's the track at Brno. I really want to watch this when we go to Austria and see if Mark rides this one the same way. But what I noticed was he had that moment. And before that moment, Marquez was very much using the edge of the tire. He was arcing off his lines. He was over on the side, elbow out, down, and riding the bike without kind of wheels in line. But he was definitely not standing the bike up and squirting it out of the corner. As soon as he had that problem and he felt the front be wrong, he changed how he was riding to where he was standing that bike up about the middle of the corner. He was getting onto the fat of the rear tire and gunning that bike out of the turns. So if he's got that figured out, I want to see this in Austria. Because if he rides the same way, then he's really elevated his own sense of what he's doing. Yeah. There's really, you know, his game, he's found somehow another level in that game.
Which is scary. Absolutely scary.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing I'm looking forward to is at Austria, Ducati has never been beat there. So I really want to see how good Marquez is on the Honda against Dovizioso there. Because that Honda definitely has an equal amount of horsepower to the Ducati. So this could be the year Marquez beats the Ducatis at the Red Bull Ring. It's something to look forward to. So it's definitely one of those things that I want to think about, I want to see, but we don't have much time to wait. It's late on Thursday night, and so we'll be into first practice sessions here really quickly. So I think we ought to wrap it up here, Joel. Don't you think?
Yeah, well, but I just one little quick snippet. What'd you think about the Grassi's comment with the testing of a new 2020 M1? I just felt like it was kind of interesting to see his impression that, and again, I know we're looking at a year in advance. It's the first test. That's all it is.
Hit me with what the comment was, because, you know, I had that work thing where I got to actually do my job.
I felt like, he was asked the question, what do you think? Anything better about the bike? And he, of course, gave a Rossi response by saying, yeah, there were some good things, but of course, not so good things. And so, but I just kind of reading what, and from my opinion, from what I saw from his facial expressions, I don't sense there's a lot of excitement even going into next year. And I just, and I know it's early, it's their first test, but Yamaha just seems to be a step behind all the other manufacturers. And I'm wondering, what is it going to take to get them to that next step? Get them back in the running.
Well, let me translate Rossi speak for you. The bike sucks. We've made no progress. I think that's pretty much what I get from that. If I could solve Yamaha's problem, I would. I don't know if it's a resource issue. You know, they're Honda is the number one biggest bike manufacturer in all of Japan. They have the most money. They have the most R&D. They have the most engineers. They have everything at their disposal to be who they are. Yamaha's second biggest. So, and their budget is probably, their racing budget is probably half of what Honda's is, to be honest with you. And then from there it's you know, Suzuki, and then you have Kawasaki after that. I don't know what it's going to take. Part of me says it's going to take Rossi getting off that motorcycle. This whole thing with Rossi right now kind of reminds me of, look what happened when Jeremy Burgess was with him, right? We went through a drought, and Rossi couldn't win titles. He wasn't riding. He couldn't find what he needed in the bike. Let's put it that way, right? Marquez had come to the fore. The new heir apparent to the throne that is Rossi, if you will. And Rossi couldn't make it work. Couldn't make it click. Couldn't really do anything. So he fired Burgess. He threw Burgess in the corner, and he got his, for the love of me, I can never remember his new crew chief's name.
Silvano,
thank you. And you kind of saw a little Rossi magic come back, right? He won a couple of races. He got farther to the front. He was more on the podium pace, if you will. And now it's kind of falling back off again. Part of that's the bike. I think part of it's got to be the fact that Rossi's, despite the fact that he's probably Superman and superhuman, age catches up with us all.
Sure.
And I mean, to be 40 years old running against a 26-year-old is incredible. It's absolutely improbable, but, you know, maybe Rossi needs a different crew chief. He needs maybe someone fresh to look at how the riding's got to change. Maybe Yamaha doesn't know which way to develop the bike because maybe Rossi is demanding something that Vinales and Quartararo don't seem to need. I don't know. It's one of those things where, we see it in hockey all the time. You trade your star player away to get assets so that you can make the team better in 1 or 2 years. Well, the star asset is Valentino Rossi. So, do you put him on? Do you take him off a factory team? No, I don't think you can. I don't think Rossi deserves to be kicked off the team or anything like that. But I gotta wonder if there's a dynamic that's inside of that team that doesn't work, isn't working. And we know that there's a bad dynamic, because when Rossi and Jorge first came into it, man, we had the wall. We had the wall down the middle of the garage, and Rossi and Lorenzo don't really care for each other. You know, is Vinales feeling the same problem? Is he under the shadow of Rossi? Does he feel like he doesn't get what he wants out of the bike because Rossi doesn't think that's the way it should go? All of this plays into it, and there's a there's a dynamic in there that I don't think any of us know anything about because we're not in the paddock. And it's going to take some time for Yamaha to figure it out and where they need to go. I mean, it's definitely not the engine. Because it's not the layout of the engine, right? I mean, they're in inline four. So is the Suzuki. Look at Renz's bike.
Good point.
Renz is fantastic on that bike. So I don't think it's the engine. It's a chassis thing. We know Yamaha was slow on the uptake of not hiring guys who worked with Magneti Marelli systems. And they kind of did it on their own. And they realized that that's sort of the wrong thing to have done. And so maybe they're just that far behind the curve with the electronics, the standardized electronics that are on the bikes. That's a part of it. There's so many moving pieces that are in this that I just don't know. But given what Rossi's comments are, man, that whatever they're trying is not going in the right direction. But then again, everyone has stumbling blocks. And KTM has a stumbling block because Zarco can't work on that bike. They couldn't get the Moto 2 frame doesn't work. So it's not like this is something out of the norm. I think Honda has problems too. I just think that they have the guy that can ride around any possible problem that you have. And maybe that's the biggest deficiency, is they just don't have riders that are there. Now, Quartararo, on the other hand, is definitely very much the next up-and-comer. He just needs some more seasoning on a MotoGP bike. Yamaha gets a bike anywhere as near as good as they have this year, maybe a little bit better, and if Honda makes a mistake and goes the wrong way, Quartararo versus Marc Marquez might be pretty amazing. I don't think Yamaha's out of it. I just have a feeling that maybe Robbie Rossi isn't in it.
It's tough.
But man, that's enough about Rossi and everything else. So that's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Thanks for putting up with the late podcast. We are in Austria this weekend, so we'll be back to talk that one again. If you want to get a hold of us, you can. Please do so by going to emailing us at motopod@motopodcast.com, and maybe you could be, if your notes and stuff, you'll get a response from all the people, from all the different hosts, and maybe we'll talk about it on the air because it might be a thought-provoking question. Who knows? But please do that, guys, and be prepared for Austria this weekend until Sunday night, I guess. We won't know the answer to the question of whether the Honda can beat the Ducati there, but I'm looking forward to it. So stay tuned, guys.